Homeopathy in Disguise, a talk given by Ian Watson to the Alliance of Registered Homeopaths Conference in London on the 9th of April 2005. Ian's current seminar schedule can be found at ianwatsonseminars.com. I hadn't realised till I set off this morning that we were actually in the Institute of Mechanical Engineers. Seems somewhat apt. And it reminded me of a probably true story of engineering students who were for some reason taking an anatomy class, and they were discussing how the human body must surely have been designed by an engineer. I'm sure some of you will know this story. And the structural engineer, looking at the muscles and the tendons in the body, said, "This is clearly the work of a structural engineer. Anybody can see that." Of course, the electrical engineer disagreed and said, "Look at the nerves and the electrical impulses in the brain and the heart. It's definitely an electrical engineer's job." Then came the mechanical engineer. He said, "Look at all these levers and joints and valves and so forth. It's definitely a mechanical engineer's hand at work here." And finally, the civil engineer piped up and said, No. This is clearly the work of a civil engineer. Who else would put a waste disposal system right through a recreational area?" Homeopathy in disguise. The idea of this talk has grown on me gradually over a period of time. I've been thinking about and witnessing how the underlying assumptions that belong, we think, to homeopathy, in fact, predate homeopathy and exist outside of homeopathy as we know it as a system of healing. And we're aware to some degree that this is true, but I think perhaps not as aware as we could be, just how pervasive the homeopathic principles are. And when I talk about homeopathic principles, there's a number that we could discuss. Well, is that a principle or is it not? But I'm going to try and stick to the ones that I'm sure there won't be any disagreement about, namely similars and one or two others. But we'll start with similars. Let likes be cured by likes. I think that this idea is one which seems to be a universal principle of healing, as far as I can determine. That's not to say it's the only way of healing, but it seems to be a very effective way of doing healing work, particularly on an energetic and on a psychological level, and even on an emotional level. This quote from Hippocrates, "Opposites are cures for opposites," I think that's similars. I'm not sure. But certainly we know that in the ancient Greek tradition, there was an awareness of the idea of using a similar energy to match that which was perceived to be the problem. And there are those who say this was known to the ancient Egyptians too. More recently, but not that much more recently, Paracelsus in the 1400s, 1500s, actually coined the phrase, which is often erroneously attributed to Hahnemann, similia similibus curantur. That's directly out of the writings of Paracelsus. Paracelsus also said, "All substances are poisons. There is none which is not a poison. The right dose differentiates a poison from a remedy." Sound familiar? In other words, the things that we take to be noxious substances can in fact be turned to good use if you know how to potentiate them. These ideas have been hinted at by people like Paracelsus and Hippocrates, and as individuals they've managed to even implement them in their own work. What they didn't manage to do was to systematize it in a way that Hahnemann did. And that really to me was Hahnemann's gift to homeopathy. He's not the inventor of the principle, as much as he was the one who was able to embody it in a healing system which was then reproducible by literally tens of thousands of people. That really was the genius of Hahnemann. And I just put an extract from probably one of my favorite quotes from Hahnemann there, from Organon, paragraph 9, I think it is. "So that our indwelling, reason-gifted mind can freely employ this living, healthy instrument for the higher purposes of our existence." It's a kind of tantalizing statement, isn't it? Because he doesn't say what the higher purposes of our existence are, but he implies that there might be one, or that there is one, or there are some. And it's that side of the equation that's become more interesting to me in the last few years. Since I retired from homeopathic clinical work, I realized that the aspect of consulting work and teaching work that still inspired me and that still interested me the most was really that to do with what happens when a person is reasonably healthy, when the homeopathy has helped them, and they've got to a certain point in their journey, in their progress, and usually as a person develops as a homeopathic client, it's not dissimilar to the way in which we develop as homeopathic students. A certain degree of self-awareness starts to take place, a degree of self-reflection, and the person starts to notice things in their life that they perhaps hadn't noticed before, and to implement certain changes. This process interested me more and more, and I felt increasingly inadequate as a, what you might call as a pure homeopath, to help people once they got beyond the point where I could call them a kind of sick person or a homeopathic client. And I literally had the experience where people were, they were in generating symptoms as an excuse so they could come back and keep seeing me to do all the work. And I suddenly realized there's a certain kind of feeling of dishonesty in that for me. Well, why not make this whole process conscious? Why not admit the fact that there is another dimension to healing work and even to homeopathic work, which goes way beyond the removal of symptoms? And I know that Hahnemann implied this, but I haven't found within the homeopathic literature the actual tools and the methods and the skills for how we're supposed to go about it. How are we supposed to help our clients with their relationship issues? How are we supposed to help them going through life transitions, middle-age crises, reaching those transition times in life when traditionally we would have maybe a rite of passage or a ritual? There'd be a cultural means of enabling a person to pass through from one stage of life to another. We don't have those anymore in this culture. Most of them are broken down, or they become empty rituals. They're meaningless. And it's left for each individual to discover for themselves what the map is for their own life's journey. But as homeopaths, we're often placed in the position where people come to us expecting us to be able to help them with those very issues. And I felt severely ill-equipped in that area. So that led me to start looking outside of the strictly homeopathic world to try and find things that I could borrow from other tools, from other disciplines, other teachers, other realms of, for example, psychology, mythology, symbolism, spiritual practices, meditation, and so forth. These have all been passionate interests of mine. And the goal has been partly to fuel my own interest and growth, but also to give me things that would help me with my clients. And I'm going to talk about some of those things today. I want to just put a little rider in there. The idea that I want to put across is not to say, well, homeopaths also need to be psychotherapists, or we also need to be qualified in counseling or something like that. If that's your interest, then all well and good, yes. But I think that we do need to have an awareness of the bigger process of a life's journey and recognize that it does go beyond symptom removal and relief of disease. That's the main message I want to put across today. And as Miriam mentioned in the introduction, one of the first, not really the first, but is someone who kind of has sat there as a figure in my own unconscious for a long time was Jung, Carl Jung. And I came across him many, many years ago and tried to read Jung when I was in my early 20s. I couldn't make head nor tail of it. It was terrible. I don't know if any of you have tried to read any of his collected works, of which there are about 20 volumes. I mean, you think Hahnemann's dense to read. I mean, this stuff is amazing. It probably suffers from the same, some of it, from the same translation problems. But nonetheless, I think Jung also had a certain way with words which you either click with or you don't. I didn't. And it was 20 years later that I came back to Jung and I found that I could actually start to make a little bit of sense of what he was saying. One of the things that Jung was very perceptive about and introduced into our consciousness was this awareness of the idea of the unconscious. I mean, really this came from Freud, but Jung elaborated upon it, and the model that we're more familiar now really is the Jungian model. He said that everything that irritates us about others can lead us to an understanding of ourselves. Very interesting statement. And what he's talking about there is this phenomenon known as projection. And projection was the name that he gave to the phenomena that happens when somebody perhaps walks into your consulting room, as an example, and all of a sudden you feel irritable and you don't know why. Or you feel like giving this person a good slap. You ever have that feeling? I frequently used to have that feeling in practice, I can tell you. Or you feel like giving them a cuddle for some reason, or whatever it is. Now, in one of Kent's famous lectures, he said that this will often guide us to the indicated remedy. You know, the story is that the child you feel like throwing out of the window is the chamomilla, and the one that you want to give a little cuddle is a pulsatilla. Well, yeah, that's all well and good, but it's also, Jung points out, it's revealing something about yourself. The kind of response that you have in the presence of another person tells you as much about you as it tells you about them, if you're willing to look at it that way. What's going on here is a kind of mirroring effect, whereby that which exists in the other person resonates with the same thing or something similar that it finds within ourselves. And according to Jung, we all carry around this piece of unconscious baggage which he named the shadow. And the shadow is a kind of repository of unconscious material. It's the things that we don't want to look at. It's the things about myself that I wouldn't like to admit to. It's the qualities and character traits that I cannot see in myself. As a result, I tend to only see them in other people. And this is called projection. Interestingly enough, it's not just the so-called bad things that we put into the shadow. It's also many positive qualities and traits as well. A lot of the things that exist within us as potentialities which have yet to be developed, we will see those as things that we admire in another person. If you see someone who comes across as very confident and very calm and very courageous or something of that kind, you think, ooh, that's great that they have that. I really like them for that. I really admire the fact that Ian Watson can stand up there and speak like this so confidently, you know. If you're feeling that kind of thing, that's also a projection. And what that means is that, those are very qualities that exist inside of you. Otherwise, you could not perceive it in the other. So similars, as we in homeopathy know, is based on this idea of resonance. One thing meeting another that is similar to itself and causing a resonance effect. And you'll find this idea coming up over and over and over again in psychological therapies in particular. Now, there's an interesting story that was came to light about Jung's work. In 1931, a young businessman went to visit Jung, who was he was American, and he was in a bad way. Despite being successful and wealthy and seemingly having everything going for him, he was mired with depression, from which he couldn't shake off, and leading to alcoholism. He had a terrible drink problem. And this man went to Zurich to visit Jung in his own clinic. And Jung did his best with the young fellow, worked with him for about a year, and it seemed like the chap was pulling his life back together, and he left and was apparently well and alcoholism free, but only for a short time, as is often the case. So they followed a relapse. This time he went into a real spiraling despair. But he decided that as Jung was the only one who'd helped him to any degree, he was going to go back and plead with him to take him on again. So he went back. Jung apparently was pretty uncompromising. And he said, listen, I've done everything that I know that can help someone in your situation. We've already worked with those things together. And unfortunately, it hasn't helped you. There's actually nothing else that I know of psychologically from my clinical work that can help you. Now, that's an interesting thing to say to a client. It's homeopathic in itself sometimes to say something of that kind. Basically, it's called telling it how it is. Because many people who come to us, and I think many times we ourselves also fall into this trap, are in what's known as denial. Denial is not a river that runs through Egypt. Denial is a state of mind that exists when we refuse to accept that things are as bad as they are. Usually that's the case. And Jung said to him, really, there's nothing else that I can offer. You need to go somewhere else. The man was very insistent, and he pleaded with him. And this persuaded Jung to offer one further suggestion. Occasionally, Jung said, he knew about cases where alcoholics were known to have had what he called a vital spiritual experience. Very interesting use of language. And Jung, of course, was very, very interested in the spiritual traditions of the world. He himself was the son of a Methodist minister, and he had been interested in all the philosophies and religions of the world from a very young age. And he talked to this young man about how some alcoholics had, for whatever reason, had gone through a kind of transformational experience where their whole center of gravity had shifted, so that all the things that were the attitudes and feelings that were dominant in their life up until that point literally fell away. They experienced a kind of inner death. And then something new and more powerful came forth. He described it in almost religious terms. He said it's almost like a conversion experience. It's the sort of language that he used. So he said to this chap, he said, I can only recommend that you place yourself in a religious atmosphere that is of your own choosing, that might be suitable for this kind of transformational experience to come forth. He said, I can't tell you where or what kind that could be. That's for you to find out. Anyway, this struck a chord with this chap, and off he went, literally clutching at his last straw. And he found himself amongst an evangelical Christian group, as it happened, for which he felt an affinity. And sure enough, he went through a process that was later described as a surrender, and what you might subsequently see as being a kind of rebirth. It was written about subsequently by a chap called Bill Wilson, who was, with this young man, the co-founder of what became Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous was a direct outcome of that interaction between Jung and that young man. And in a later letter to Bill Wilson, Jung wrote that his craving for alcohol was, on a low level, the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness. Expressing it in medieval language, he said it's the union for God that man was seeking. He went on to say, you see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus. And you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. Spirit against spirit, you might say. Now, if that's not like yours, like, I don't know what is. The interesting thing is that this was actually built in to the 12-step program, as it became known. The first stage of the 12-step program, as some of you may be aware, is to recognize that you are of yourself powerless to help yourself. There is a prerequisite of surrender, of handing over the cure, if you like, to something bigger than the ego. There's a recognition that you're helpless in and of yourself. You've got to a certain point there where something has to break, and it has to break down in order that something else can come through. And this is the first of the 12 steps. And it's helped literally millions of people throughout the world, not only with alcohol addiction. Other people have followed up this theme of Jung's. Notably, Stanislav and Christina Grof have done some remarkable work with addicts of various kinds. And there's an interesting book, if any of you are interested in this particular topic, several, in fact, one by those authors called Spiritual Emergency, where they describe that process in great detail. And another is the Thirst for Wholeness, where Christina Grof talks about how the craving for an addictive substance, such as alcohol or drugs, very often is a substitution for a spiritual hunger, a spiritual thirst. It's very interesting. There's an interesting quote from Bill Jung, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says somewhere in one of his letters, one of his writings, that many people who fall into alcoholism have had what he calls a glimpse of the absolute. In other words, they've had a brush with the divine, you might say. And it's very interesting to me that glimpses of the absolute are played upon by certain vodka manufacturer nowadays. It's described as the absolute temptation. Something very interesting psychologically is going on there. One of the traditions that's always been interesting to me is the Zen Buddhist tradition. It's rooted chiefly in Japan. And this character, Shunryu Suzuki, was one of the two Suzukis who took Zen Buddhism to America, and therefore to the West, really, in the 1950s for the first time. And he established a retreat center there, which became quite well known. And one of the things I always loved about Zen, you're familiar with some of the famous Zen koans, I'm sure, the statements which are not understandable by the rational mind. The interesting thing with Zen is that it requires you to embrace a paradox, which is a very difficult thing for the mind to do, because the mind lives in a realm of duality. Well, something is either this or it's that. It's either good or it's bad. I like it or I don't like it. It's homeopathy or allopathy. We know one thing by contrasting it with another. But in order to deeply understand and deeply perceive something, we have to go beyond duality and recognize that we in fact need two things in order to know one. I've written in my recent book, The Tao of Homeopathy, that homeopathy would not really exist without allopathy. They need each other in some strange sense. I think the idea that homeopathy will one day triumph and allopathy will no longer exist is a naive idea that only homeopaths subscribe to. And it's a bias, you know, it's a prejudice. It means you've settled on one side of a coin. And when we identify, when we over-identify with one side, guess where the other side goes? Into the shadow. Which means we better watch out, because the shadow contents have a nasty habit of showing up when we least expect them, as Jung was at pains to point out. So, one of the stories that was told about Suzuki, he had a meditation retreat center where there's a community of people living, practicing really traditional Zen Buddhism, although in a Western setting. And there's a lovely little story of a guy who was feeling the power of temptation whilst training to be a Zen Buddhist. And he had a terrible problem with controlling his appetite. And this chap always was sneaking into the kitchen and stealing extra bits of food when nobody was looking, which of course was forbidden in this semi-monastic setting. And it went on and it went on, and he was always snacking. He would get people's leftovers without them realizing, and raiding the fridge and this kind of business. Anyway, eventually his conscience got the better of him. He decided he was going to go and confess. So he requested an audience with Suzuki and went to see him in his office. And Suzuki said, "What can I do for you?" And he basically told him the story. He said, "Look, you know, I know we have these rules and I do my best to keep to them, but I just can't help myself. I'm always so hungry and I find myself just needing to go out and I keep snacking and I feel so bad about it, you know. I don't know what to do." Suzuki didn't say a word. He just had this benign smile on his face as usual. Anyway, he reached under his table, opened the palm of his hand, he said, "Here, have some jelly beans." Which to me is homeopathy. And what it points to is what I would call one of the hidden principles of homeopathy, which is to do with acceptance. I think I call it a hidden principle because it's not really written about in the homeopathic literature that we normally read. But I think acceptance is one of the basic principles of healing, whatever kind of healing you're doing, whether it's self-healing or working with other people in a therapeutic setting. We have to be able to meet that person as they are and accept them as they are. And we call it unprejudiced observer. Basically, to be able to take the person as they are, warts and all, and say, "You know what? You're okay as you are. This is okay." That's healing in and of itself. And this was obviously one of Suzuki's gifts. He was able to accept that person with his so-called problem. And acceptance is healing in and of itself. And if you can accept something and then even mirror it back to the person, say, you know what, this is okay, have some jelly beans. In that instant, that individual got the message. He realized he was just creating some story and beating himself up about it, which is in fact a form of egotism. You know, look how important I am. I've got this story, I've got this problem, and so on and so forth. And the recognition from the Zen teacher was, you know what, just let it go. You're okay as you are. And when you can bring that kind of open-hearted acceptance to something that is perceived as a problem, very quickly it just dissolves by itself. That is a remedy, in some sense. And there are, I've personally have met individuals who had that capacity within themselves, that loving acceptance that they could bring. And you could see the people's anxieties and problems literally just dissolve away without necessarily needing to give them the pills. I think that we can bring this into our homeopathic consultation work, and many of us do. But as Miriam said earlier on, one of my passions has been, well, if we're going to do it consciously. We can bring some conscious awareness to that process of acceptance. It seems to enhance it somewhat. Of course, the great challenge is, if you're going to accept problems in other people, we have to be able to accept them first within ourselves. And this can require a lifetime's work, if my experience is anything to go by. Now, one of the other things that I would argue is a principle of homeopathy is that the healing is recognized to come from within the person. It's not imposed. The remedies don't do anything that is healing in and of itself. The remedies are merely catalysts, and the consultation and the practitioner are also only catalysts, the aim being to trigger the self-healing capacity that's recognized to be within that individual themselves. And implicit within that is the idea that somewhere within the person's problem is also the seed of their solution. So there's a recognition that there's a wisdom in the symptoms that the body puts out. We may not necessarily understand it. We don't frequently understand it. Why does this person have migraine and that person has a stomach ulcer? Sometimes we know. Sometimes we can get an inkling why it should be that particular organ or system or that type of ailment. But often it's mysterious. We simply don't know. But we kind of have a background assumption, or I do, that there is nothing random about it. That it's meaningful in some sense. And it contains within it the seeds of its own healing possibility. Not only that, there's another area where homeopathy turns problems into solutions. As Paracelsus pointed out, we take poisons and we turn them into healing potentials. We take things which others would consider rubbish, inert, worthless, useless substances, even dirty, disgusting substances. Look at our nose oats, for goodness sake. I mean, the things that homeopaths use nowadays for remedies, it's no wonder that some people are a bit stretched by the concept of homeopathy when they discover the kind of things we're prescribing, you know? But what they're missing is that through the potentization process, that substance in its crude form is being transformed into something else. There is an alchemy that takes place in the potentization process. So this idea of turning that which is seen as a problem, which is seen as something harmful, into something which is beneficial, is also, to me, that's one of the hidden principles within homeopathy. And of course, you find it elsewhere. Paracelsus was aware of it. He says, our own nature is itself our physician, which is to say, it has in itself what it needs. That's become one of my guiding principles in my consultation work, is to have as a kind of operating assumption that I don't know what this person needs. I don't need to know what this person needs. All I need to be able to do is to facilitate them discovering what they need, which is already known to them on an unconscious level inside. That's how I see my role as a practitioner. It's not my job to tell people what they need to do to heal. My job is to be a facilitator so that they can access and tap their own self-healing resources, which are there within them already. One of my favorite therapists outside of the realm of homeopathy, who I learned a great deal from indirectly, was R.D. Lang. He was a Scottish Glaswegian psychiatrist by profession, but he was about as far away from traditional psychiatry as you can get in terms of the way that he practiced. He embraced meditation as one of his psychotherapeutic techniques, and many other things as well. He was very against the use of chemical substances in the way that they're traditionally prescribed in psychiatry. He was not averse to experimenting with other kinds of chemical substances. He was an experimenter and he was an innovator, but he, like Hahnemann, felt that much of what is done in the name of healing is in fact barbaric. When he looked at practices like ECT, electroshock therapy, he felt that this was really inhuman to be carrying out this kind of treatment on people who were mentally disturbed. And so he was constantly looking for other ways to work with people. There's a lovely quote from him there. The treatment is how you treat someone. It's that idea again that the therapist is a large part of the cure. Carl Jung used to say, it's what you are that heals, it's not what you know. It's the same idea. I think that anybody who really goes into the healing process in any depth tends to arrive at a similar conclusion, that there is that property which is to do with the interaction between two human beings, which is ultimately healing in and of itself, irrespective of the outer form, you might say, that the treatment takes. Now, Lang felt that a person could, if given a safe and supportive environment, be encouraged to find their own healing solution to most of life's problems. One of his innovations was to set up what became known as safe houses, which he had a number of scattered around the country. And these were basically houses that were looked after by people who worked with him, where people who were having some kind of a crisis or a breakdown could go to break down safely and to be held, so that the space could be held and they could be allowed to go through their own process without any intervention. And what a radical idea, doing nothing. To me, that's homeopathic too. It's doing the least that's needed, which is frequently all that's needed is just to hold the space for that individual and to let them find their own resources. He applied this very successfully to treatment of schizophrenics, for example, and noticed that what this society, our current society, labels as a schizophrenic episode, if you transport that same phenomena to a different culture, they would often describe that person as going through perhaps a shamanic crisis. It's the same thing. They would have the same kind of visions, they'd describe the same internal process, and frequently the same physical symptoms would manifest. The difference being that that culture had a context, they had a container which gave some support to that process. That person was actually revered as a shaman, and it was recognized that they had to undergo. Epilepsy was a similar thing. It was described as a problem in one culture, it was seen as a breakthrough opportunity in another. All depends on how you look at it and where you're looking from. And one of the stories that R.D. Lang told interested me because it had within it this idea that people will find their own solutions, but it also struck me as a homeopathic story when I heard him tell it. And it was a story of a young woman that went to see him. She was suffering from periodic catatonic episodes where she would literally just fall asleep, although not really asleep. She would just kind of go into this almost semi-conscious state and stay there for periods of minutes or sometimes many hours or the whole day. And then she'd suddenly come back to life again and pick up where she left off. And this was obviously interfering with her studies. She was a university student and was becoming increasingly problematic. One day she found that she'd made herself a cup of tea in the morning. She was drinking the tea and then she suddenly came to and it was about 4:30 in the afternoon and she was in the same position holding the cup of tea as she'd been at 9 o'clock in the morning, imagine. I mean, it wasn't harmful beyond that, but it was nonetheless distressing. So she went to see Lang and he commented that the standard treatment at that time that he saw her, this is probably in the 70s or 80s, was ECT. Literally, the idea was to shock the person out of the problem, which he didn't recommend at all. So he said to her, look, if you know, if you're afraid that I have some places that you could go where you can, you'll be safely looked after. But otherwise, he really was at a loss, a bit like Jung. He couldn't really find anything in his therapeutic repertoire that he could offer as a, as an intervention. So he decided to adopt one of his strategies which he'd found worked with other clients, which was simply to create a safe space within the consultation. So he said, I suggest we just sit together quietly for a little while. And they sat for about 20 minutes in what you could only describe as a meditative space. And at the end of it, he said, okay, the consultation's time's finished now. If I think of anything else, I'll let you know. And if you feel like you need to contact me again, you've got my number. And that was it, basically. Nothing happened, you know. But interestingly, this young woman commented later that when she left his consulting room, she said her mind was a blank. So rather than the usual chatter, 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 what am I going to do next? What? And that was very strange, wasn't it? All the normal thought stuff. Somehow there was a real stillness had come over her just by entering into this space with Lang. And as she's walking back to her apartment where she lived, there's a one of those news agents that have all the little cards in the window advertising this and that. And one of them literally seemed to jump out and grab her as she walked past. She'd probably walked past 100 times and never noticed it. Today it jumped out. And it said there was a studio where they did life drawing classes. And they wanted models for which they would pay. And basically, the idea was that they would pay people to go into one position and stay there for an hour or two while the students would make sketches and models. And it struck her that this was something that perhaps she could do and earn some money. Lang joked afterwards that she effectively found a way to market her catatonia. And she did. She went along as she signed up and she went on a regular basis. And she would go into a position and stay there voluntarily and was probably very good at it. And the students drew her and painted her, and then at the end she'd go back to her daily life. And this went on for about 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, suddenly during one session she was sat in the unusual position, and for the first time she started to get restless. She found that she actually couldn't maintain the still position anymore, so she decided it was time to quit. And from that moment on, she was entirely cured of these catatonic episodes. Which is interestingly homeopathic, is it not? This very interesting thing happens when, if you do voluntarily that which your body-mind is trying to do involuntarily, you kind of meet in the middle somewhere. And this is a principle that's been utilized by a number of different therapists, each in their own way. The next one I'm going to tell you about was probably one of the most radical innovators in this whole field. And this guy was called Milton Erickson. He died in 1980. There's a whole branch of hypnotherapy known as Ericksonian hypnotherapy, which is named after him. He looks pretty foreboding in that picture. He's the only one I could find. But I'm assured that he was, in fact, a very gentle and loving character and great fun to be in the presence of. One of the other things that he points to, which I think, again, is one of the basic core principles of homeopathy, he says, I invent a new theory and a new approach for each individual. Well, we know that's important, too. We have to individualize each case, the way we take the case, the remedy we prescribe, the response. It has to be individualized to get the best response. One of Erickson's therapeutic tools as a hypnotherapist was not to put people in trance, as we normally think of hypnosis. If we don't know much about it, we tend to imagine the idea that someone is going completely unconscious and then basically being instructed to do this, that, or the other. He could do that, and early on in his career he did a lot of that, but he quickly realized that it wasn't necessary at all. And most of what he did subsequently was could be described as light trance work, where the person wasn't even aware that they were in trance, in the sense that they were fully conscious. But he found that just by changing your voice pattern a little bit, changing the rhythm, the way that you spoke, you can speak to people in a different way, and it will reach a different place of them. So he would often have what looked like the appearance of just a regular conversation. And yet, in fact, he was speaking directly to their unconscious, which is the place where our behaviors are chiefly governed from. Now, a character came along to see him one time who, as in the Jung story, was a confirmed alcoholic. This poor chap had been alcoholic for many, many years, as had many of his family members, so there was a genetic predisposition, as is often the case. And he was what would generally be considered a hopeless case. He'd tried everything and nothing seemed to work. And instead of going into a detailed history and so forth, Erickson just began rambling on about, in his usual way, about something which was apparently completely unrelated to this poor chap's predicament. And he had this way of just rambling on, completely oblivious to what was supposed to be the real problem. And he started asking this chap if he knew about a certain park across the way, the other side of the city. And the guy's like, well, yeah, I've heard of it. And he said, well, you know about the botanic gardens that they have there? And the guy said, no, not really, no. He said, oh, you should go there. It's amazing. You know what they have there? They've got a tropical house. Fantastic stuff. They collect plants from all over the world. They put them in this tropical house. You know some of those plants, you know what they are? Cacti. They have a whole cacti house. Now, I can see some of you nodding off now because I'm using Erickson's voice patterns. And he said, you know what? They have plants in there that can go for years without needing a drink. Now, you should go visit that place. Anyway, if I can help you further, you know where I am. And he sent the guy out. And the guy came stumbling out of his office, completely bewildered, thinking, who was that guy? What on earth was he talking about? Cactuses, plants, and da-da-da-da. And of course, what he's doing is planting seeds directly into the unconscious. Several years passed. He never heard sight nor sound of the chap again. And one day, he had a busy practice. There were always people waiting to see him. One day, this woman came bursting in, insisted on having a short appointment with Erickson without having pre-booked. And he was basically moaning and grumbling. But anyway, she was so insistent that he gave her 5 minutes. He said, okay, what do you want? And she said, I just want to shake your hand. And he said, why is that? And she said, I needed to meet the man who could talk to my father about cacti 2.5 years ago and have him not touch a drop of alcohol since that day. Because she said, it's been completely astonishing how he's transformed his life. And I needed to meet the person who could do that. This guy was entirely cured from the one session. This was actually a principle of Erickson's work, was that his aim was to cure people in one session. And he felt like he hadn't done his best job if it took two or three. You know, that to him was second best. I think that's kind of interesting. That is also homeopathic, isn't it? We talk about minimum intervention. Well, that's it. One session. If you hit the button, that's what it takes, you know. You can establish a whole new direction. If that person within the space of that session establishes a whole new direction, it's a bit like moving an oil tanker, you know. It takes a while to get it moving in a different direction. But once it's going that way instead of this way, it's going to keep going. You won't necessarily need to do much else. And his interventions were frequently so spot on that he was able to do that. In that sense, they were truly homeopathic. He did very little, but the ripple that it sent out was very, very large. One of the other, so this became known as a therapeutic metaphor. That's the technical term for what he did in that chap's case. He had many, many, many other kinds of tools, a number of which were homeopathic in different ways. The use of metaphor is basically telling a story, something which is analogous to the person's problem, but you're not directly referring to it at all. So you're apparently talking about something else. Erickson also had this very unnerving skill whereby he could talk to one person, but he's actually doing the work on another at the same time, which he used to demonstrate in lecture theatres such as this. So if he had someone heckling or giving him a hard time, for example, he'd be doing work with them completely unconsciously while he's supposedly interacting with somebody else. It was a very interesting character. Now, he also did work in hospital institutional settings where people were literally hospitalized because their disturbances were so great that they couldn't lead a normal life. And sometimes he found that a simple amplification of that which was already manifesting is all that's needed to bring it to a kind of resolution. This, to me, is really the essence of what homeopathic remedies do. When we give a remedy to someone, what we're giving them is a little bit more of what they already have. We're giving a remedy that matches the symptom picture that they're already presenting. They're presenting belladonna. We say, what you're doing is great. Have a bit more. That's really, to me, the whole basis of energy healing through similars. And of course, it applies on different levels too. So Erickson was very skilled at applying this, and he had a case of a chap which he observed. He was a businessman, or had been, who'd had some kind of a breakdown. He was a former industrialist, made a lot of money, he was very successful, and then he'd had some kind of a breakdown. He'd ended up in this psychiatric wing, and he was stuck there. And basically, he developed these automatic motions of his hands, where his hands would constantly go up and down in front of his chest like this. He couldn't stop himself. It went on and on and on and on. And he was in a state of despair. Erickson observed him over a period of time, and then one day he decided to try something. And he went up to the chap and he said to him, so he's matching his body movements somewhat, so there's homeopathy there too, the mirroring is taking place. He said to the chap, I see that you've had your ups and downs in life. Which is an interesting observation. And he said, I wonder if you would do something for me. And the chap said, yeah, sure, what is it? And he gave him a block of wood and a large piece of sandpaper. And he basically guided the man's hands around the block of wood with the sandpaper so that while he's going up and down, he's sanding this piece of wood. He said, would you mind just smoothing off this piece of wood for me? And the chap said, no, no problem. And when he finished that one, he gave him another and another. And after a few days, the guy got interested in what he was doing. And he realized that if he applied a little bit more pressure here and a bit less there, a certain shape or a form would emerge out of the wood. So he wasn't just smoothing it randomly anymore. He was sculpting. And within a few weeks, he started to carve the wood as well as sand it down. Within a few months, he was producing chess sets, intricately carved pieces, which he was selling to his fellow inmates and the visitors that came. And very shortly after that, he discharged himself completely cured and became once again a successful businessman and went on to lead a healthy and productive life. He was entirely cured of this condition, having been hospitalized for some time. He subsequently made a fortune in real estate. The willingness to innovate that Erickson showed, I think, is the hallmark of any great healer in any line of work. And I've learned a lot from him about giving yourself permission as a practitioner to sometimes do something a little bit unusual. You know, when the standard responses are not working, sometimes you need to come from left field, as it's known, to be able to look at it from a completely different perspective. And what he's doing there is, again, taking what looks like the problem and turning it into a solution. You know, most people would look at that automatic motion as a symptom, as a problem. We've got to prescribe something, muscle relaxants or something of this kind, to stop that happening. Even in homeopathy, we can get into thinking that way, that these symptoms need to be taken away that are bothering the person. Erickson had this peculiar way of looking at people that said, well, maybe the body's doing that for a good reason. What would happen if we found a way to go with that, to work with it rather than to reduce it? He was very skilled at this. Another of his tricks was to prescribe the symptom that was supposedly the problem. And he would do it, for example, in a systematized way. There's an example of a case of his was a young girl that was brought to him. She was maybe 11 or 12 or something like that. And she was still sucking her thumb, seemingly to annoy everybody around her, particularly her parents and her other family members, because she would do it in such a way that it was completely in their face and obnoxious and making, you know, these terrible noises. And everybody was driven nuts by it, basically. And so once again, instead of seeing this as the problem, he saw it as an opportunity. So what he did was he gave her prescribed periods of thumb sucking, which she must adhere to during the day on a regular basis. So you've got to do 20 minutes thumb sucking between 9 o'clock and 9:20, and only in the presence of your father. And then at lunchtime, I want you to sit with your mother and make sure you suck your thumb for at least 25 minutes. And you mustn't stop until the 25 minutes is up. And he got her to agree that she would do this. And of course, a few days after she's been doing this for 25 minutes, she soon got bored of that, you know. And she cured herself. She basically found other ways to get attention from her parents. This is called prescribing the symptom. You take the thing that looks like the problem and you give it back to the person. You say, what you're doing is great, just do it a bit more. He had another case of a chap, similar to the one I described a minute ago, who also had unconscious automatic motions of a hand like this, just one hand, this young man's case, which he couldn't stop. He was moving rapidly all the time. And neurologists and so on had tried to cure him unsuccessfully. They concluded it must be psychological, but they didn't know what to do. So Erickson watched him very closely, and you know what he did? He counted the number of times that his hand would go up and down in a minute. And it was something like 152, something like that. 152 movements per minute. So he had a stopwatch and he counted. That was the average. So he said to the chap, he said, I've noticed that your hand goes up and down 152 times every minute. Did you know that? He said, no, I didn't. He said, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, very interesting. He said, do you think you could do it 160? And the guy said, I don't know, I'll have a go. So he got him to speed up a little bit. And sure enough, he found he could do 160. He said, isn't that interesting? He said, well, if you can do 152 and you can do 160, I bet you can't do 140. And of course, if you say, I bet you can't, what does that bring up in a person? Well, I'll show you that I can. So of course, he managed to slow it down to 140. And then Erickson said, oh, let's try 165. Can you do that? He said, yeah, 165. He says, now, which do you prefer, the faster or the slower? And the guy said, well, the slower is probably better. He said, yeah, let's try 120. What's he doing? He's introducing incremental change, which initially is so small that the person doesn't even notice. But what he's also doing is he's putting the person in a position where they are now in control of the symptom rather than being a victim of it. You see how quick that can happen? Just by showing the person that they can speed it up and slow it down. It's no longer the body ruling their life. They can now recognize that, they can modify this. So he had the guy slow it down, and then one day he decided to stop. That was it. Another cured case. These cases are quite amazing. If you ever feel like entertaining yourself in between clients, I recommend reading some of Milton Erickson's case studies. You'll be rolling about on the floor laughing by the time your clients come in. It's some of the funniest material I've ever read. This idea that if we do something to the point where we're finished with it, we complete it, is implicit in the homeopathic idea of similars. I think it was William Blake who said somewhere that the path of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. If you bring anything to completion, to fullness, to its natural conclusion, then it's finished. If you try and jump there too quickly, you'll find you revert back to where you were. If you try and resist going there, you'll find you keep getting pulled to the same place. But there is this kind of idea that the unconscious knows where it needs to go. Our body wisdom knows where it needs to go to bring some kind of healing resolution. And what we need to find is a creative way that we can facilitate the person going there, which is a way that is safe for them and productive rather than destructive. This idea of amplifying that which is already there, I also came across when I trained in journey process work with Brandon Bays. And the basis of her process work was discovered through her own self-healing journey. She had a large tumor, was told that it was basically going to be life-threatening if she didn't have a major operation. She decided to see if she could heal herself and found that, yes, she could. And after she'd gone through the process, she then was able to describe the steps that she'd gone through. And the key component was a form of emotional release. The key element of the emotional release that she realized was the necessity to, first of all, bring acceptance to that which is already there. There's that word again. And then secondarily, not only to accept, but to amplify it a little bit. So if there's grief there, rather than try and replace the grief with joy or happiness, what was required was to go into the grief, to amplify it a little bit more, to feel it fully. And she found that when she did that voluntarily, something in the body would actually take over and the process would complete itself by itself. And this she discovered to be universally true of all emotions. All emotions, there's no exceptions, whether it's guilt or anger or fear, whatever you're dealing with. What we tend to do is run away from the feelings that we don't want to feel. And we try and move towards the ones that we perceive to be the pleasant ones. And that, of course, is opposite when we're moving away from something. The similar approach is to recognize what's there. What is it that the body is trying to feel right now? Oh, it's fear. It's anxiety. Okay, move towards it and see what happens. What would happen if you allowed that fear to be fully felt? One of the techniques that Brandon uses was to bring in other fear to add to it. She would say, well, if it's not quite enough, think of all the other times you've been afraid as well. Bearing in mind, this is an interesting thing, which is known to anybody who's done work with the unconscious, is the recognition that the unconscious doesn't know the difference between the real and the unreal. Or you could say between the imaginary and the real. It's the same stuff. The proof of that is the nightmare experience. If you wake up from a nightmare, supposing you just imagine you've been chased by a robber or a tiger or something of that kind, when you wake up, you'll have all the physiological symptoms in your body as if it had really happened. Your heart will be pounding, your blood pressure's up, your pulse rate is up, your body temperature will have changed, you'll be sweating profusely, etc., etc., as if it had really happened. Now, that's both good news and bad news. That means we can literally worry ourselves into a disease state. I mean, we can, we know that. It's called psychosomatic illness. But the flip side of that, which people like Erickson and Brandon and Jung have used to the therapist's advantage, is that we can also use the active imagination to conjure up states which produce healing response. So if you've got a feeling state which is not very strong, it's not very intense, you can amplify it literally by the power of your imagination. You could imagine a time when you felt really sad, and it will start to bring forth the corresponding physiological response. So journey process work is very much an inward focused process. You don't have to go out and recreate all the things that may or may not have happened to you. You can imagine them inside of yourself, and that's what it does. So similar still seems to hold good on the emotional level. So it seems to work therapeutically better than opposites in most circumstances. I think the old adage goes, what we resist persists. And the corollary that I added to that many years ago was, what we accept dissolves. And that seems to me a universal principle of healing. A guy called Lester Levinson found something very similar through his own self-healing process and became subsequently known as the Sedona method of self-healing. It's the same idea, emotional healing through accepting what's there and even welcoming it, amplifying it a little bit. I also did some training in Shen therapy, S-H-E-N, Shen therapy developed by Richard Pavek, based entirely on the same understanding. This is an energy body work where you use your own energy body. It looks like hands-on healing from an observer's point of view. All you're doing is amplifying the energy field of that person. You're augmenting their energy with your own temporarily. When you bring more energy to a certain place where the energy's been blocked or stuck, you'll find a corresponding emotional release takes place just by itself. It's what the body does naturally when we get out of the way. So healing on this level is actually quite simple. The hardest thing for most people is to get is how simple it is. That's the paradox. One of the most innovative and entertaining therapists who's worked in this field is a guy called Frank Farrelly. He was actually accused, if that's the right word, of being a homeopath in disguise by a fellow doctor in Germany where he was giving lectures. The guy said, what you're doing is homeopathic psychology. Do you know that? And I don't think he really knew about homeopathy, but he probably got the point. Farrelly said, yes, there's pain and suffering, but the ultimate truths do not lie in anger and pain. Life is also the theater of the ridiculous and the absurd. Laughter has more truth than tears and depression. So that gives you something idea of the basis of his therapeutic work. Usually there's a lot of humor involved. The therapy that he developed is known as provocative therapy, which is a pretty scary term, isn't it? Would you go see a provocative therapist? Well, I might if it was him. I probably would. You know, the word provoke comes from a Latin term, provocare, which means to bring forth or to draw out. So that's not so bad. The idea is to bring forth whatever is within that person that needs to be healed. And the idea of provocative therapy is to create the environment, once again, that will enable the client to discover their own solution to whatever they consider to the problem to be. Farrelly also worked in a hospital setting in a similar way to Milton Erickson, and worked with some pretty severe cases, people who'd been locked up for years. And his breakthrough came when he was working in a psychiatric wing, and he had interviews on a regular basis with some of the people who were in there. And he described it later as, I'm pretty sure this was accurate, it was the 91st interview that he'd had with this same chap. So he'd seen the person 90 times previously. And each time, there's a guy who was diagnosed schizophrenic, and he was in a state of varying degrees of despair, grief, sadness, depression, you name it. Always had a gloomy, pessimistic outlook. I was always entirely convinced that there was nothing going to be able to help him. Previously, Farrelly's approach had been pretty much that he'd been taught, which was to try and reassure the guy, you know, no, it's not so bad, it's not as bad as you think, you know, you've got this and this going for you, and pretty soon you'll start to get better, which of course is allopathy. It's opposites. You know, trying to convince someone that the way they see the world is not true, it's actually the opposite, you're using opposites. Now, on a psychological and emotional level, opposites tends to produce resistance. The more they say it's like this, the more you say it's like that. And the more you say it's like that, the more determined they are to prove to you, no, it's like this, really. So it tends to produce a kind of entrenched position on the part of the client. Now, Farrelly's own description was that he actually, one day, he just got tired of listening to the same story and knowing that his standard response was not going to be effective. And he just got to the point where he said, oh, I've had enough of this. So he basically flipped it around and he agreed with the guy. He said, you know what, you're right. You are a hopeless case. I agree with you. I don't think there is anything that's going to help you. You're absolutely right. And of course, this stopped him in his tracks for the first time. Interestingly, he was kind of noticed, first of all, that this brought a new response from the person. He started to think about what was being said. And so he decided to see what would happen if he emphasized it a little bit more. Amplification, again, you know. In fact, you're the worst case that I've seen in all the time I've been with. You know, some of these people will be out of here in a few months, but I don't hold out much hope for you. Now, this is playing on this polarity response, which seems to be a basic aspect of the human psyche. When someone tells us we are like this, something in us goes, well, I'm going to show you that's not true. So this guy suddenly, the client, suddenly found himself protesting that he's not as bad as Farrelly was making out. And he was going to show him. And he did. And proceeded to get himself better and discharged quite quickly. Now this, of course, was an eye-opening, revelatory experience to Frank Farrelly. And he very quickly decided that he had to work in a completely different ways. You could say he became a homeopath in that moment. And this became the basis of his provocative therapy. One of his most famous cases was also in a hospital setting. It gives you a nice illustration of how innovative he was as a therapeutic worker. It was a guy who was in a serious delusional state and had been for as long as anybody was aware, to the point of hospitalization. And he had the classic delusion, which you all know is in our repertory, that he was Jesus Christ. And he told everybody that he was Jesus. He wanted people to call him Jesus. And he, for all intents and purposes, acted and behaved in accordance with that he was Jesus. And everybody had tried everything to convince him that this wasn't true, of course, and it hadn't worked. And one day, this chap appeared at his bedside, dressed as a carpenter, this chap being Frank Farrelly. And he took out a tape measure, got the guy to lay out his arms like this, and took his measurements in the bed, without saying a word, took his measurements, made a note, and then he came back a short while later with two very large planks of wood. Put them down, one a bit longer than the other, this is a true story. He put them down by the bedside, we got some nails out and starts banging away. At this point the poor patient was getting increasingly hot under the collar, as you can imagine, and he says to Farrelly, what's going on here? And Farrelly looked at him, he looked at the bed, he looked at his notes, he said, you are Jesus Christ, aren't you? At which point the bubble burst, you might say. No, you've got the wrong guy. That was enough to break this guy's delusional state. He came out running from that delusion, you could say, and was insistent that he was definitely not Jesus. He got him mixed up with somebody else. Now, I'm not recommending you do that in your consulting room, although if you get the opportunity, it sure would lighten up your day, wouldn't it? So Farrelly has many, many hundreds of such cases where he uses provocative therapy. Most of them are a little bit more subtle than that. It's a simple one-to-one, but sometimes he would amplify with a little bit of drama, you might say. Now, one of the other key components of homeopathy is the idea that we achieve the most by doing the least. And we do this in several ways, partly by using just the one remedy wherever we can get away with it, also by using the potentization approach. So we take the crude substance and we reduce it, but we're also potentiating it. And as you've already heard, some of these other workers in other fields, like Erickson, had the same basic thing built into their practice and clinical work. Erickson, as I said, had the aim to cure people in one session wherever he could. Now, this idea, I think, is a basic principle which applies across the board too. This chap, Vilfredo Pareto, was an Italian and worked in the field of economics and philosophy. And his basic idea could be summed up in that statement. A minority of causes, inputs, or efforts leads to a majority of the results, outputs, or rewards. Well, that's all very well. What does it mean? Well, in everyday language, it's what's known as the 80-20 principle, which some of you may have heard of. And this was first put into those words by Pareto. It also became known as the Pareto principle and has been studied by economists, among others, ever since. He discovered that the land in Italy at the time that he lived, 80% of it was owned by about 20% of the population. And then he studied at various different times in history, and he was found that, give or take a few percent, this was always the case. And despite the best efforts to equalize the situation of various movements and so forth, it always seemed to gravitate to that basic imbalance. Then he looked around at other countries and he found that the same thing was largely true. And it applied to the distribution of wealth to a large extent as well. The vast majority seems to be held and shared by a relative minority. He was also a keen gardener. He later observed that 20% of the pea pods that he planted in his garden yielded 80% of the peas. And this 80-20 principle has been subsequently tested and found to be, as a general rule, it's not always strictly 80-20, but you get the idea. It applies in many different walks of life. In society, for example, it's been found that about 20% of criminals commit or are responsible for about 80% of all crimes. You basically got a small number of people wreaking a large amount of havoc. About 20% of motorists cause about 80% of accidents. That's kind of homeopathic in a bizarre way. This is an interesting one. 20% of those people who get married, this is one for Prince Charles, comprise 80% of the divorce statistics. Isn't that interesting? People who divorce once have a habit of doing it again, apparently. Some people many times. In business, it's been found that about 20% of any company's products would generate about 80% of that company's sales value. If only they knew which 20%. You could say something similar about advertising. About 20% of any advertising a company does would generate at least 80% of subsequent business. One famous business person said, at least half of my advertising is very successful, if only I knew which half, you know. They could cut their advertising budget by 50% straight away if you knew which half it was. About 20% of customers for any business would also account for about 80% of your sales. You tend to get the same people coming back buying more and more stuff. If you look in your own house, about 20% of your carpet gets about 80% of the wear. That observation led to the idea of carpet tiles, where you could replace just the worn out section rather than the whole thing. If you look in your wardrobe, about 20% of your clothes will get worn about 80% of the time, isn't it? So why don't we throw out the other 80%? Well, you never know when you're going to wear them. About 20% of the energy produced in your car engine produces about 80% of the motion. It's even less if you've got an open fire. More than 80% of the energy produced in an open fire goes up the chimney. I started thinking about how this applied to homeopathy. And I figured that it was definitely true that something like 20% of the remedies that I knew got prescribed about 80% of the time. Isn't it? Even though we know all these hundreds and thousands of little interesting ones, what do we end up giving? Time and time and time again. The familiar pulsatilla and so forth. I also realized that probably 80% of my referrals came from 20% of my clients. And it was definitely worth finding out who they were and treating them very well. I also realized that about 80% of the aggravation I suffered from my clients came from about 20% of them. So it was also worth discovering who they were. It also occurred to me that when I looked at a typical case history, I probably based the prescription 80% of the time on about 20% of the symptoms. Really, that's what we do. We don't prescribe on the totality. We prescribe on a selective partiality. Really, that's what we do. And the art of remedy selection is the art of knowing what to ignore, what to leave out, which is the bulk of the case. So the 80-20 principle, it seems to me, is striking a homeopathic chord somewhere, is the recognition that small causes have large effects, more than we'd realize, in fact. And this, of course, is a principle of Taoism, too. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. And the interweaving of those two was the basis of my book, The Tao of Homeopathy, the recognition that Taoism as a philosophy is a system that's based on observation of nature. And nature is, on the one hand, very abundant, but on the other hand, very efficient. So whilst nature has no problem in producing thousands and thousands of fruits, for example, from a single tree or something of that kind, and most of them will fall to the ground, only a few getting eaten. At the same time, nature is incredibly efficient in the sense that everything gets recycled. That there is this recognition that it can be put to use, often in hidden ways. Another therapist who's made use of this principle is Arnold Mindell, who with his wife Amy Mindell have done some very innovative and interesting work. Mindell was a Jungian initially by training, but has since gone on to do all kinds of other interesting work of various kinds with individuals and groups. And he says, we must be able to identify all the parts in a system and allow them to speak. All the parts in a group, even those we don't like or believe to be useless, must be present and supported. That to me is also a homeopathic idea, that everything is valid, everything is useful. It's often the little thing that you would otherwise ignore that gives you the clue that is most needed. One of the ways that he works with that is to take a person and to find out what's bothering them. He say, oh, well, it's my boss at work. You know, he's terrible. He's a real tyrant. I can't stand him. He just treats everybody so badly. He's Mr. Angry all the time. I'm afraid to go to work because I don't want to see him. What he would do is to turn that around and say, well, maybe you need a little bit of the boss inside of you. He actually calls it homeopathic, even though he doesn't prescribe remedies, as far as I know. The idea is that you need to take a little bit of that which is bothering you. This is the shadow idea again. If something is bothering you or disturbing you from the outside, what that's telling you is you need to integrate a little bit of that into your own nature. You need a bit of that aggression, probably, or a bit of that whatever it is that you're seeing as being a disturbing quality. So he'd get the person to try it on. He'd say, just imagine, just fantasize. You get to be boss for 5 minutes. Off you go. You get to do all the things that they do. And you know what? What he'd find is the person, after a while, once they got used to the discomfort, they'd really enjoy it. Because they'd really enjoy being the tyrant for 5 minutes or something of that kind. Why? Because it's in them anyway, but it's suppressed. That's why it's bothering them when they see it on the outside. This idea of a systemic understanding, I think, is also not unique to homeopathy, but is implicit in our homeopathic work. Bill Mollinson was the coiner of the term permaculture, and working in agriculture and gardening, recognized that there are certain principles which, if you apply to any agricultural setting, whether it's a small holding or a large-scale farm situation, there are certain principles that seem to work. And the quote from him there, everything gardens. And recently I was visiting a friend and I was scouring their bookshelf and I came across a book on permaculture. I didn't know that much about it, although I'd heard about it. And in the introductory chapter, it gave the principles of permaculture as outlined by Bill Mollinson. They actually call them Mollinsonisms or something like that, or Mollinsonisms or something. I thought, that's cute. They've named these principles after him, and I read them. And they were, I'm literally quoting word for word. The first one was, work with nature rather than against it. I thought, okay, that's homeopathic. The second one was, the problem is the solution. Well, that's homeopathic. The third one, you like this, make the least change for the greatest possible effect. The guy's a homeopath, he doesn't know it, but he is. The fourth one was, the yield of a system is theoretically unlimited. That's potentization. If you find a way to tap the resources of nature, you find that it's actually unlimited. You know, you start with one acorn, you can end up with a whole oak forest. All you got to do is keep reproducing. That's the potentization idea. And his last principle was that everything gardens. The idea there is that everything has an effect on and is affected by everything in its environment. So teaching us to look and think systemically, not looking at things in isolation. If we do treat things in isolation, we create new problems. That's what the permaculturists discovered. That's also what we discover in homeopathy. One of his colleagues, Masanobu Fukuoka, Japanese gardener, recognized this. He says, if we throw nature out of the door, she comes back in the window with a pitchfork. Well, I think we call that suppression, don't we? It's the same idea. We replace one small problem with a larger one. I'd like to finish with a little story which was told by, I can't remember who. It concerned Hering. Constantine Hering, who was a contemporary of Hahnemann, took homeopathy to the US from Germany and lived until 1880, I think. And Hering, later in his life, his second wife had died and he was very depressed and grief-stricken and developed an aversion to women, it was told, which was out of character for him, apparently. And became quite melancholic and couldn't shake it off to the extent that it was affecting his practice and his homeopathy and everything. And the root of the melancholy was that he felt that he'd neglected his wife during her life. He loved her dearly, but he'd been so busy with his practice and writing his 10 volumes, Guiding Symptoms and so forth, that he felt he hadn't really appreciated her fully. Anyway, one day he was persuaded to go and see a ballet, which was not his favorite art form by any means. In fact, he detested the ballet, but as it was a German dancer who was coming, he decided to give it a go. And he went, and the performance, he described subsequently, was very beautiful. And it told of a mythic tale, I think it was a Greek tale, of a goddess who comes to earth as a mortal and falls in love with a human being and marries him. But the young man, not knowing any better, didn't treat her so well. He essentially clipped the wings of this angelic being, and to the extent that she died, sadly, and had to return to heaven. Now, he was deeply moved by this, was Hering, and he came away and reflected very much on the theme, and he said subsequently that he was pleased to report that his melancholy was cured in accordance with the law of similars. Because he realized that that theme mirrored his own life story, and that somehow, just by participating in that story and seeing it enacted on the stage, it healed him of his melancholy. He subsequently remarried a third time and bore further children to his third wife, Therese. That's a nice story, I thought. I liked it. So thank you all very much. It's lovely to see you all here today, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you.